So into Matthew 9 then. It's a trip that you're having, I believe, is this the third week into a trip through Matthew's Gospel? A kind of look through the big sweep of the story, the accounts, the true accounts of Jesus, really, who he is. That's the main point. And you're focusing on that main point, aren't you? You're calling the series "A Worship the King." Jesus himself is the central figure. He's the point of the Gospels. That's why we read them. That's why they're there. That's why they're there. That's what they're there for. To firstly, to introduce us to Jesus. If we don't know quite who Jesus is, if you're here this morning thinking, well, I wonder what Christianity is really about, then the Gospels are a great place to discover. Because Jesus is the central figure, and he's the one that we read about in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. So we discover Jesus. But we're reminded of him. Those of us who've been Christians on the road a long time need to be reminded of the one we're following, don't we? And so it's a great place to be reminded of him. And it keeps us in touch with him, doesn't it? We're introduced to Jesus, we're reminded of him, and we're kept in touch with him as we go through this Gospel of Matthew. And as we do this, so we discover, maybe we rediscover some of the answers to some of those key questions that immediately flow out of any kind of meeting with Jesus and the pages of the New Testament. The question, well, who is he then? What does he do? What happens when he's around? So that's the kind of the approach I want to take this morning. Worship the King. Jesus is presented in Matthew's Gospel as the King, the one who comes with great authority and yet humility as well, as we know. And I believe last time you were looking at chapter 8, is that right? Chapter 7, chapter 8. And you were thinking about that theme of majesty, Jesus' authority as the King at work. And did you notice his authority? As you went through those incidents in Matthew 8, did you notice what Jesus can do with a word? He says to a leper, with a word, he just says, "Be clean," and the leprosy sufferer is cured from his leprosy. He has a conversation with that Roman soldier. Do you remember that? And the soldier says to Jesus, "Don't come to my house, just say the word, and my servant or my son, whichever it was, will get well again." In verse 16 of chapter 8, remember he talks about Jesus driving out demons with a word. He does it. In another story, in that maybe you went into last week, when he, what did he do with the wind and the waves? He rebuked them with a word. He calmed the sea. Following on from that, you meet that man who had loads of demons, and with a word, Jesus says to the demons, "Go." Go, and they went. And in the last episode you would have looked at, we see Jesus saying, you know, that argument he has with the Pharisees when he says, "Which is easier for me to do? Is it easier for me to say, get up and walk, or to say, your sins are forgiven?" With a word. So you get this big picture of Jesus with his kingly authority. The power of his word, that someone who can come and speak a word and have an impact upon sickness. Upon for the leprosy sufferer, in his case it was a ritual impurity as well as a sickness, over nature, over demons, over human sin, forgiveness. And there you have this great picture of Jesus the King coming with this authority to deal with this and that and this and that. And you see that big picture. That, if you weren't here last week, that's just to catch you up on it. And if you were, well, I hope you, that's helpful. And now we come to chapter 9, and we meet here a man called Matthew, a man who works in customs. It is probably in Capernaum, a town just on the north western side of the Sea of Galilee. And almost certainly, as I say, he worked in customs and excise, because on the other side, the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, was another region which was run by a different government. Herod Philip ran that part of the kind of country, that state, and the other Herod, Herod Antipas, ran the area around Capernaum and the rest of Israel, as we know Israel today. And so goods would come across the lake into Capernaum, and taxes would be paid on the goods. So almost certainly Matthew, if he worked by the lake, was there collecting the duty as the goods came through. That was his job. There's another possibility. There was a great road that went from Syria to Egypt. Great trade route, right from Syria, as you know, is northeast of Israel, and then that road went right down through Israel, down into Egypt. And again, at the customs, you'd have to pay tax on the goods that went through. So Matthew had a good job. It was a bit rough. Of course, on occasions he had to kind of get the money out of people who perhaps weren't too willing to pay, and he wasn't particularly popular. Who is? You know, anyone who's making money at the border, collecting money for the government, you know, on behalf of the people you don't like, you wouldn't be very popular, would you? And then, of course, there was the problem that being a Jew himself and living in a Jewish community, a religious community. Well, who were the people coming from Syria, coming from the other side of the lake? Well, they're all Gentiles. Goodness knows what they were bringing down to Egypt. I don't know whether they're bringing pigs and dead animals or whatever. You know, all the kind of stuff that the Jews wouldn't go near. They wouldn't go near Gentiles. They certainly wouldn't go near the kind of stuff that Gentiles were happy to carry. So Matthew and his kind of friends would be not particularly popular. They wouldn't exactly be flavour of the month. They wouldn't be A-list celebrities in your party kind of invitation list, because they were ritually unclean, as well as being a little bit dodgy and a little bit kind of extortionate, and generally not particularly savoury characters. That's how it was. So it was a rough job. It was well paid, but he was probably a bit unpopular. So here's Matthew then, sitting in his office in Capernaum, maybe having a coffee break, thinking about what he's heard about Jesus, because everyone has heard about Jesus. Look at the things he was doing in chapter 7, all round Galilee. And then one day, as he's having his coffee break or whatever he's doing, the door opens and in walks Jesus of Nazareth. Stands there in his office, hasn't got anything to declare because he didn't own anything. Simply says, well, he has got something to declare. It's a couple of words. It is, "Follow me," he says to Matthew. This king with authority, all that authority, that authoritative word that, you know, is out there somewhere, you know, healing leprosy sufferers, calming waves, casting out demons, saying people can be forgiven, all that stuff that Matthew'd heard about, this king kind of somewhere else out in Galilee, arrived in his office in front of him. And that same authoritative word says straight into Matthew's life, "Follow me." And Matthew does. He decides to quit his job and follow Jesus. But what happens when the king walks into someone's life and asks them to follow him? Well, that's what happens, isn't it? I wonder whether that can kind of happen to us. You know, we hear about Jesus, we hear about this king in the Gospels, this king out there somewhere, this king who does this, that and the other in other people's lives, other people's baptisms, other people's families and so on. And then one day, or gradually, we sense this King Jesus actually walking into our lives and saying, "Hey, I've got something to say to you. I want you to follow me." He's not just the king kind of out there for other people. He has that habit of walking into our lives and asking us to follow him. Are you there? Have you been there? What's it like for Matthew? What's it like for us? Well, it's certainly radical, isn't it? In Matthew's case, he quits the job. It's final. He's probably not going to go back. I suspect that someone else would very gladly take his well-paid job, you know, who wants to employ an ex-tax collector? You know, he wouldn't have exactly been a popular figure around the tradesfolk of the Sea of Galilee. So it was probably scary. He doesn't know what's going to happen next, does he? So what then? What was it like? Well, isn't it interesting, verse 10, what does he do? Well, he throws a party. And he invites many, there are many others there. We read more about this party in the other Gospels, Luke and Mark, but it's what we do read, because this is almost certainly Matthew's own account. He says many tax collectors, there were many there at his house. So he says, come on guys, come and have a party, come and meet Jesus, come and meet the disciples. Yeah, well, I've already got 13, might as well have another 20, 30, 40 or 50, we don't know. But there were certainly many of them. So as Matthew follows Jesus, it's going to be scary, it's going to be unknown, but it's certainly not grim, is it? You know, if he was kind of miserable about it, if he was thinking, oh no, I'm, you know, everything in the past is behind me, oh, I've got to follow Jesus, he wouldn't be throwing a party, would he? There's a lot of joy in this. And so it is for us. Even though there's a cost to follow Jesus, there's joy in the following. And look, secondly, the guests, like Matthew, were not exactly A-list celebrities, were they? Well, they were like Matthew, they were his friends. The tax collectors and the, quote, sinners, these were people who were basically beyond the pale of the Jewish kind of religious community. People who, if you sat by, you had to go into, if you touched one of them or ate from their food plate or whatever, then you had to go to some kind of ritual purification before you could go back into the synagogue. Yet they were those kind of people. It's a bit like the people who showed up when Jesus was born, the shepherds. They were like that. A bit like the three wise men, if there were three of them. They were Gentiles. No one could have any trouble with them. Interesting, isn't it? Jesus attracts the people who were on the outside of the religious elite. So Jesus as king then comes into people's lives, and it's good news. That's the first point. It's good news. There's a party. Something is going to be different, as we shall see. And I suppose there are three questions. First of all, are you there yet? Have you got to that point where Jesus has actually come into your life, or you said, yeah, okay, Jesus, I will follow you? Do we believe, secondly, if we've got to that point, do we actually believe that it's possible for others as well? Do we believe? Do we look like people? Do we live like people who believe that? To believe that it's possible for the king to come into the lives of any other person. And not just that it's possible, but when he does, it's good news. There's joy in it. It's not about grimness. It can be tough, it can be scary. But it certainly isn't grim. Because Jesus is there, as we shall see. So this incident prompts two questions about Jesus. And behind these two questions is a bigger question, really. The big question is, well, if Jesus is a king who comes into people's lives, what kind of king is he? Did you see the two questions in this passage? If you've got it in front of you, you might just look down and see. I want to look at them and ask this bigger question behind them, what kind of king is Jesus then? What are the two questions? Well, number one is there in verse 11 to 13, isn't it? Who asked the questions? The Pharisees asked the question. Who are the Pharisees? They were the religious people. They actually ask a hostile question, and the question they ask the disciples is, why does Jesus have meals with sinners? How come all these riff-raff, these beyond-the-pale tax collectors and sinners elsewhere in the Gospel, says that he had a lot of friends who were prostitutes, and people just on the outside, as it were? The Pharisees say, why is he having dinner with these people? See, the Pharisees believe that to be right before God, you had to do all this outward stuff. You had to be religious. You had to keep the law of God in every tiny detail. Not just the Ten Commandments, but all the rest as well that the Jewish people were given. And they figure that if you did all of that, it didn't really matter, you know, what you were like on the inside, if you just did all the right stuff, then you'd be fine, you'd be righteous. And so for the Pharisees, it was really crucial that they kept away from Matthew and people like him, because if they didn't keep away from him, then they were going to be polluted by them, and they'd have to go through loads of more ritual to make up for the problem, so to speak. And Jesus answers this question with a picture, doesn't he? See the picture there? The picture is that of the doctor. I don't think doctors here, I think, this morning, but I guess they'll agree with it. You can talk to them afterwards if you would like to. But the doctor, a doctor has come, or a doctor exists for sick people, not for well people, although preventative medicine, all that, but not go into that. But anyway, as far as Jesus is concerned, at the time, the doctor was there for sick people. Jesus is saying, look, I'm like the doctor. I've come not for people who think they're righteous. I've actually come for people who know they're sick, who know they need my help. And he quotes the Old Testament when he says to the Pharisees, verse 13, go and learn what this means. That's actually, if you're interested, a kind of technical term that was used to people when they were talking about the law. It was a term that meant, you know, go and look at that carefully. You know, you need to go and study that. It's not kind of, Jesus isn't saying to them, go away and read Hosea chapter 6. He's saying, just think about, you know, next time you're, you know, thinking about God, think about what it means in Hosea chapter 6, verse 6, which is what he quotes. I have not, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. That's what God says there. And in the Old Testament book of Hosea, God is saying to the people of Israel, look, you're doing all the right stuff. You're coming with your sacrifices, you're coming with your offerings, you're doing this, 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 and this, but your hearts are far from me. You are in a desperate state. In fact, he said, if we were married, if we were a married couple, God says to the people of Israel in Hosea, he says, if we were a married couple, you are committing adultery. That is how far away from me you are as my people. You might do the right stuff, but your heart isn't there. And Jesus says to the Pharisees, guys, you just go away and think about what Hosea said. That it's about the heart. It's about mercy. It's about God's characteristic of mercy in your life. Not about how many sacrifices you can plop up, or how many services you can attend, or how many times you come to communion in a year, if you like. And Jesus is challenging the Pharisees. And he's saying this: all this focus on outward stuff misses the point unless your heart is right. And Jesus is saying to them, are you really righteous? He's saying to them. Jesus comes like the doctor, and he comes for people who know they need him, who know they're sick. Not so-called well, righteous people. What does this tell us about Jesus? What kind of king is this king? Well, he's kind of, if I may put it this way, biased towards the unrighteous, isn't he? I mean, just think about how radical that is. Aren't you a little bit outraged by that? Just a tiny bit? that Jesus prefers to be with unrighteous people than righteous people. Can you imagine how it must have felt to the Pharisees? They must have been absolutely, you know, livid, apart from anything else. That how it must have just broken their kind of whole, all the categories in their thinking are being blown apart here. He's saying, guys, I'd rather be with Matthew and his friends than you and all your religious people. At the same time, claiming to be the Messiah, which was even more outrageous for the Pharisees, who were expecting a certain kind of Messiah. He's biased towards the unrighteous. He prefers to be with people who know they need him. Got that? Jesus prefers to be with people who know they need him. And look at this community then that forms. It's only a short community, it may have been a few hours, with Jesus at the centre, the disciples, and all that bunch of people in Matthew's house. He's at the centre of it. Look at his purpose, verse 13, second half of verse 13. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. I've come to call sinners. I've come for people who know they need me. So that's what it tells us about Jesus. What does it tell us about us? Well, here's a question again. Do we see ourselves as unrighteous? Do we see ourselves as sinners? people who have just not got it to cut it with God in any kind of religious kind of league table, whether it's the Premier Division or the conference. What's it called? Is it the conference? It's the bottom one. Is that the conference? Yeah. Sorry, I got that wrong. I should have prepared that image earlier. Do we see ourselves as righteous people, or how do we see ourselves? Do we see ourselves as people who don't belong in a party of tax collectors and sinners? Well, the problem with that, if we see ourselves that way, is that that's where Jesus is. At the centre of a party of tax collectors and sinners. Are we like Jesus? Are we, as a community of God's people, are we kind of like the equivalent of Matthew's party in his house? Or do we sit with the tut-tutting Pharisees? Well, I'll leave that for myself to answer and for you. What's the second question that comes, verses 14 to 17? This time it's not from hostile Pharisees, but it's from the disciples of John the Baptist. They're a bit confused. They're not hostile. They just want to be something cleared up. And Jesus' disciples, Jesus rather, how is it, they say to Jesus, that we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast? And Jesus answers with another picture. It's the picture not of the doctor this time, but of the wedding. And particularly of the way that then in Eastern weddings, and I believe it still happens today, even in the West, that sometimes the bridegroom and his friends might get together either at the wedding. Sometimes in Eastern weddings there's a whole kind of day or two of, you know, basically an Eastern wedding can last a number of days. I was in Bangladesh a while ago and I went to day three or night three of a wedding that I don't know how many days it was going on, but it was a nice meal anyway. But that's another story. But that was the night that the bride was introduced to all the bridegroom's family. So that happened on day three. I don't know when they actually got the marriage ceremony done, but anyway, it went on for days. So it was in weddings of the time. And so there was this time when the bridegroom was together with his friends. And Jesus said, well, imagine if you're in that setting and you're friends of the bridegroom, you're there with the bridegroom. How can you be somber then? How can you be long-faced and fast when you're at a wedding? How can you be somber at a wedding? Or, dare I say, a stag night? Although, let me just say, in no way am I endorsing the regular kind of British stag night, which seems to me to be degenerating greatly. But yeah, the idea is that how can you have a somber and a miserable stag night when you're there with the bridegroom and he's there and you're there and so on and so forth? And Jesus is saying a lot here, but we won't go into it, but there's a reference here to the idea that when Messiah came, he would have a great wedding banquet, and the Pharisees, or John's disciples rather, would have known that. But the point Jesus is making is that the bridegroom is here now, the focus of the attention. Jesus is saying, it's like me, I'm the bridegroom. And my disciples are like the friends, my friends, and it's, you know, and it's the time when we're together. And that's a time to be joyful. He says the time will come when the bridegroom will not be with the bridegroom's friends. And maybe that's a reference to what we've remembered here this morning. So we need to realize that joy does not mean the absence of pain, does it? And you don't have to be a Christian very long before you work that one out. But Jesus is saying that at this time, no, he said, my disciples are not fasting now because it's a time of joy, because the bridegroom is with the bridegroom's friends. But you see, John's disciples are saying something else. They're saying, we and the Pharisees, we fast. He's saying, we're doing the right religious thing. He said, we're being good Jews. The Pharisees fasted for their reasons. John's disciples fasted for their other reasons. They were basically doing the religious kind of behavior in the context of the time. And the John's disciples are saying to Jesus, why aren't you like us? Why are you different? That's what they're asking. And Jesus says, what I've come to do is new. That's the point. And he uses this, another picture, the picture of a new patch. You don't put a new patch on an old garment. You don't put new wine into old wineskins. Jesus is saying, listen, I haven't come to patch up the old religion. I've come to do something new. Old wineskins will never take new wine. And what I've come to give, what I've come to do, is radically and totally and completely different. Yes, he says, one day my disciples will fast. There's nothing wrong with fasting. But the point he's making is that I have come to bring in something new, something that is different, something that is so different from the old way of doing religion, as it were, than, you know, it's like old wine or like a new patch on an old garment. What does that tell us about Jesus? What kind of king is he? Well, surely his kingship, when it touches our lives, is about us being with him, just like the bridegroom is with his friends. And so joy is part of that, although, as I said, that doesn't mean the absence of pain. But it is about a whole new way of, quote, doing religion, I suppose. What does it tell us about Jesus? His kingship is not about patching up old ways, old lives, old situations, but about something completely new. I had a great email from one of my colleagues the other day. Well, I've got time for a quick story. I'll finish less than 5 minutes. Is that okay? Quick story. This guy and his wife, they work in up on the kind of Tibetan grasslands in China. And he's a water engineer, and he's doing stuff up there. Very interesting stuff. But anyway, they basically need a vehicle. Okay. We don't buy vehicles and supply vehicles. We supply people. So we're in touch with their church about how to raise the best kind of money for a vehicle that they need. Two options for the vehicle. You either buy a £17,000 Toyota Land Cruiser, which all the other NGOs drive around in, you know, like the UN, and all look really smart and everything. Or you buy a Chinese Jeep, which is made in China, usually falls apart, any Tibetans that drive them, and, you know, there are parts everywhere, everyone knows how to fix them. So the cost of that is, I'll tell you in a minute. So what you do, you get, what he's going to do, what his plan is to buy one of these Chinese Jeeps, and also make friends with one of the Chinese Tibetan mechanics he knows nearby, and they'll buy the Jeep, and they'll basically buy a second-hand one. No point buying a brand new Chinese Jeep, because he says it will probably break down pretty soon after you buy it. No deference for Chinese or people worrying about China and road. I've just realised where I'm going here. I better be a bit careful. Stick with me. We're coming to the punchline. So you buy the second-hand Chinese Jeep. You get a friend who's a mechanic, and basically, once you've bought it, you take the Chinese Jeep to pieces. Every main part in the whole thing you replace with a brand new one, and in so doing you learn, so he's going to learn how to maintain and fix and keep the Chinese Jeep running by basically replacing everything in the old Jeep along with the Chinese mechanic. Okay, cost of that, about £2,300 for the Chinese Jeep, the mechanic and all the parts, and what you learn is priceless, as it says on the thing. Where am I going here? Well, see, what my friend Chris is doing is not patching up an old Chinese Jeep to make it work till it falls apart. It's only an analogy here, it's not a total kind of parallel. But what he is doing is basically completely renewing it. Completely, you know, it'll look like a battered up old Chinese second-hand Jeep, but it'll be just completely new on the inside. And Jesus is saying, what I've come to do is not to patch things up, but to completely rebuild them, to make everything new. And okay, you may still look like an old Jeep, you may feel like a very old one and a battered up one, but Jesus is someone who knows what they're doing, kind of renewing you, rebuilding you. Jesus doesn't patch up our lives, he makes them new. Why? Because he's there. Remember, the bridegroom is with the friends of the bride. The bridegroom is with his friends. And because he knows what he's doing. So what about us then? Let's not just do the religious thing. Let's realize that the bridegroom is with us. You know, let's realize that that makes a difference. Let's realize that Jesus doesn't patch up the old, but brings something completely new when he comes with his kingdom. What kind of kingship? Well, one that comes into our lives, that brings changes, that brings joy. What kind of king is he? A king that loves eating with sinners, that goes for the sinners and the people who know they need him, not the righteous. A king who doesn't bring patches for our lives, but who renews them totally on the inside. And a king who continually brings new life into new wineskins. Come on in and taste the new wine.